Yeah, so first of all, welcome to the slight chaos of today. It's real pleasure to be here. I was just thinking as I was laying out a rainbow flag on the side of the altar here and even putting these words up on the screen, I was just thinking, oh my goodness, this so would not have happened when I was a little kid growing up where I grew up. So it's kind of like a bit of emotion, but also I just want to share with you something a little bit about a little bit of my own journey, but more importantly the work that I do, and particularly just to kind of frame it as to where we are. We're sitting in a church here. We're sitting here. Here we go. Because no presentation is complete without a PowerPoint presentation. It's so 20th century. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story because I think it's useful for you to know who is talking to you. And then I'll talk a little bit about LGBTI identities, that they are complex and intersecting. Some reflections on trans and same-sex attraction identities. I'll talk about some of my work on LGBTI rights, and I'll talk a little bit of my work with the World Council of Churches as well on the reference group on human sexuality. So then this is the slide which I get to talk about me. So there I am. And that was when I was about 4 years old. Now, those who know me can't answer this question, but does anyone know what I'm wearing? Who doesn't know me? Does anyone know what's on my shirt? Does that mean anything to anybody here? That is a Salvation Army logo, the Salvation Army. In fact, I think it's in Norwegian, ironically. So my name's Andre. I am South African. My parents are Salvation Army missionaries, and they were missionaries in Zambia when I was born. My father's a doctor. So I grew up in this little village in the middle of nowhere in southern province, near Mazabuka, called Chikankata. And my parents were deeply wonderful, deeply spiritual people. Some of you have met my father. Salvation Army has this thing, this habit of sending their missionaries around the world. So I got sent, my parents got sent from missionaries to Zambia, to missionaries to London, then missionaries to India, and then eventually they went home. And my story was I followed them. I grew up Salvation Army, and then when I was at boarding school in India, I ended up going to an evangelical, a happy clappy church, charismatic. And then when I went to university, I went to a conservative evangelical Church of England church, and I got baptized there. And then around about all of that period, because hey, surprise, surprise, I'm gay, my sexuality also became a very big thing in my life and really felt like it was balancing or conflicting with my faith. And so my story ended up being one of deep, and I think it's a fairly typical story for many lesbian, gay, bisexual people in particular, and trans people too, of a deep wrench, feeling that somehow my faith was telling me to do this, but I was feeling like I was this. And there was a deep rift for me, to be honest, and a lot of agonizing where I kind of said no to God for a long time and really walked away. And said, how dare you make me choose? With a lot of anger and a lot of fear, I really felt like I was being told to choose. And so I went away and did the rest of my life. And probably it was about, I don't know, 7, 8 years ago that I finally felt a coming back. And it was mainly through this church, through a friend of mine, Elizabeth, who basically said, get to church, stop whinging about this, don't turn it into you can or you can't. Kind of get over it and come and sit here. And I sat here in the back for a few Sundays and really felt a lot of healing coming up and just the opening up of my heart that I couldn't work with all those difficult texts and I couldn't work with all of this tradition and all of the things I was being told, so I just let it go. And I felt just an incredible movement of the Spirit, which just said, I love you as you are, come to me. So you'll find interspersed here, just little bits of the Bible that I'm throwing in, because this isn't a talk about LGBTI rights per se. It's a story about faith and sexuality. It's about Jesus and LGBTI rights. So I keep wanting to come back to the Bible. And I grew up in a good, strong evangelical tradition. So I'm very proud of that heritage. And I'm very, and the Bible means an incredible amount to me. So I'll come back to that now and then. So enough about me. About 5, 6 years ago, I started working on LGBTI rights. However, sometimes we don't call them LGBTI rights. Sometimes we call them, I have to remember, TH2K K rights, and I'll explain why. Because I want us to get back to the understanding that what we're actually talking about, because I think when we hear LGBTI, we think, oh, no, it's all about like the gay brigade, and it's all about some complex politics, and it's about churches fighting on ordination, and it's about same-sex marriage. And I just want to pause on all of that, because I think that's just the craziness, and I don't think we ever remember the people, the children of God that are involved. So we're just going to have a look at some people here. So first of all, here is Crystal, who is from the Tiwi Islands in what is now called Australia. And Crystal was biologically born male, but does not identify as that. So Crystal identifies as sister girl. Like, some people would say that she's trans. That's kind of the easy way that Western people can like impose a word on it. But actually her identity, which is deep in indigenous Tiwi Island culture, is to be a sister girl, and she sits with a very respected position within the community, but it's also a very complicated position, which involves use of sex work as well within Aboriginal people in the Tiwi Islands. So this is Crystal. Here we have Rani from Pakistan. Rani identifies as Hijra. Some of you may know what Hijra is. Within Hindu tradition and culture, Hijra people occupy a special spiritual place, again, often biologically born as male, sometimes born as intersex people. They have special rights and position within temple culture. More often than not, you'll see them at traffic lights when you stop in the streets in Bombay. Sorry, Mumbai now. When I was there, it was Bombay. They will come up to the taxi, and they'll knock and they'll ask for you to give them a bless. They'll give you a blessing if you give them some money, and they're known to be bringing good luck and good fortune. But again, a very complicated experience that they face, because people will say, okay, Rani, you have a role in the Hindu faith. Do your thing there, but don't you dare try and come and work here. And we don't really want you living next door to us because you're a little weird. So that's Rani. Here's Kent from the Cree Nation on Turtle Island, now called Canada and the United States. Kent, under Native American culture, two-spirited people often have this great sense, you know, I think it's one of the great gifts of indigenous peoples to our times, is their a deep sense of spirituality and a different way of viewing the world, which includes this idea that spirits can be split, that there can be a feminine side and a masculine side. And so probably under our acronym insistence, he would probably identify as gay, but under indigenous native North American culture, he would identify as two-spirited, so like the number two. And again, but would face very typical issues that gay men have faced in the past of exclusion and, you know, we don't want you working here, we don't want you doing this, occasionally getting violence on the streets. But also would face like the double whammy of being an indigenous person as well and having to like somehow live your indigenous culture in modern day 21st century Canada or Turtle Island. Here's Nong Thum from Thailand, Koh Toi. Those of you who've been to Thailand will know that there's great fun and laughter. Anyone who's a what they call ladyboy is the kind of more standard term for it. But Koh Toi are also deep in Thai culture, and that's an identity that they go with. Again, very similar. People will say, "Ah, oh, you are you're the fun bit of society. We like you. Come and sing. Yeah, that's fantastic. We love you. You're a man, but you're dressed in women's clothing." So people often will mentalize and place someone into a specific role and say, "Okay, you have a space, but here's your space. But don't shift out of who you are." But again, complex. So it's we don't have that, for example, in European society. So actually, one of the interesting things on LGBTI is that actually it's not really LGBTI. We have to understand the world is complex in our sexualities and our genders. And a few thousand miles to the east, we have Fafafini from Samoa. Here's Liz. Again, Fafafini operate somewhere on the masculine, feminine. They're both. And within Samoan society, again, it's typically somebody born biologically a man will present, if that's the right word, as a woman, and operate that specific space in society. And in Africa, Amira from Nigeria, Yandaudu in northern Nigeria. Also, you can see typically like a gay man, but dressed very femininely and an effeminate approach to his gender and to his sexuality. So when I meet these people in my work, I get to meet people. We are fearfully and wonderfully made as human beings. And I think that always just gives me like a huge moment of like, it drops into my heart, because each of these people are people. I am a human being, you are a human being, and we have other creatures as well. But each of us is fearfully and wonderfully made. And for us, that really is the starting point. And so when I'm working on my LGBTI rights, it's very easy to go out and wave this flag very proudly, and we do. But at the same time, there is also, I'm very grateful for my faith, because it gives me a moment just to pause and to come back and to say, that's right, we are each fearfully and wonderfully made. And I think that's something which the rest of the world needs to learn, in the sense of to get over our transphobic and homophobic, etc. But it's also very much a lesson for LGBT in particular, and to some degree intersex people as well, a lesson to learn is that I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Because I think so much of the hate is actually self-imposed, that people grow up in Christian traditions or Muslim traditions or even atheist traditions or Buddhist traditions, and they grow up thinking, I'm not good enough, I'm not right, I need to be fixed, I'm bad. And I think that the number of people I speak with who've had a wonderful moment of the Spirit entering into their lives and saying, I love you for who you are fearfully and wonderfully made. Okay, yeah, who likes Christmas time with all the gingerbread you get? So not gingerbread, but genderbread. I could sit here for like a day and talk with you about the alphabet soup of LGBTIQ2S+++. It's always growing, it's incredible. And I will not do that for you, because you've got the internet and you've got Google. If you're interested in this, I suggest that you do Google genderbread person, I think it is. Yeah, you see the non-gendered word there. What I want to highlight here, though, is that we often squeeze LGBTI or LGBTIQ into one thing. And I think we basically have to pause and say, again, what is this about? Someone's sexual orientation, their attraction to another human being, whether it be a romantic attraction, whether it be a sexual attraction, whether it be a spiritual connection, your orientation of attraction is one thing. That's about being lesbian, gay, bisexual. And I emphasize it's not just sexual, because I think sometimes when we have this debate, people think we talk about children, like gay children, and some people say, oh, how dare you? My kids aren't, you know, we're talking about sex and children. And I think it's to understand that from very young, children are expressing their attraction to other human beings. It's like my best friend. And then that best friend becomes an even more special friend. And eventually that might be expressed sexually. But, you know, I think it's trying to understand the complexity of our attraction. So our orientation, our sexual orientation, our attraction orientation is one thing. That's very much in our heart. In our head is our identity of our gender. We're each born into a body that we wake up in the morning and we get in the shower and we look at it and we go, okay, here's my body. And I look down and I'm like, okay, I'm a guy. Okay, that's like my gender identity. And I'm happy with that. I'm like, oh, that's right, this body matches what's in here. If I woke up tomorrow morning, got out of bed, into the shower and looked down and realized that I had a woman's body, I'd be like, whoa, what's going on here? And it would just completely mess with my head. And I would know in my head that I'm a guy, but this body doesn't actually match who I know I am. And so again, it's often that deep knowing of who you are and what your gender is something deeply held within us. And yet sometimes that doesn't match with our bodies. And so for trans people, that's a lived reality. Some people learn or look at their bodies and say, you know what? My body will be different from my head. Okay. And a lot of trans people live like that. Some trans people will say, I would like, in a process of becoming, I would like my body to align with how I think of myself. And so some trans people will then go through surgeries or you know, some surgeries, sometimes going all the way, sometimes not going all the way. So there's a variety of being gender identity, but I want to emphasize that it's something that you feel in your head. It's like you wake up and you know, I am a man, or I know that I am something in between. It's something deeply held. Our gender expression is what we present to the world. If I got up this morning and took out my makeup kit and put on lipstick and beautiful eyeliner, I'm expressing my gender in a different way. I might know that I'm a guy, but I might want to express my gender in a certain way. Maybe I'm very comfortable with being a guy, but actually my natural way of being is very flamboyant. I'm a woman and everyone calls me a tomboy my entire life. A little bit of that is about my gender expression. I'm not confused about who I am. I'm not confused about who I love, but I'm still choosing to be who I am. So gender identity, gender expression. And the last one, which I think is actually the simplest one to understand, is sex characteristics. And that's the bit between your legs. And as you know, when a little kid is born, what's the first question? Is it a boy or a girl? And yet for nearly 1% of the world population, the answer is, we don't know. And so people are born and have been born since the beginning of time. In fact, we are all created in between. Even in our mother's womb, as we are developing and growing, there is a stage in our growth when we present both male and female sex organs. And for some people, that continues through birth. And so when it comes out, we don't know what to do. We're like, oh my goodness, fit into a category, get into male or female. And yet we are beautifully and wonderfully made. So I hope you've got it all sorted. I hope that's all 100% clear. Because if so, then please tell me, because this is also the moment when I fall to my knees. Because I think this is an important part in the Bible for me. For now we see only a reflection and as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And I think for issues of sexuality, and I think for issues of gender, we as individuals, but we as a species, we as creation are on a journey of understanding. The conversations we have today are conversations that could not have happened 10 years ago. Imagine this conversation 100 years ago. Imagine 500 years ago. And yet human sexuality and gender have been with us the entire journey. And so, understanding, our LGBTIQ plus may not be perfect, but we're doing our best and we're learning to understand and we're learning to understand ourselves and we're learning to understand others. And I think it's the humility of coming into that discussion and saying, okay, we know this much, we don't know everything yet, but let's live in love, let's follow your way, and we will find the way forwards. So that's the first 1, 2, 3 bits done, you'll be glad to know. I'll talk a little bit about my work specifically. I work in advocacy at the United Nations, where we have two amazing documents, one from 1948. Thank you to the governments of the world who came together and agreed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. All persons are born free and equal in dignity and rights. And then secondly, we've had the Sustainable Development Goals, which have been agreed just in 2017. Again, people saying this is on, you know, where we put our resources for development over the next 15 years. Ensuring that no one is left behind. So with all the complexities of LGBTI, what I do in my daily work is actually go into the United Nations spaces and ensure that those people, Rani, Kent, Liz, and others, that their stories are heard, so that we don't forget that Rani is born free and equal in dignity and rights, and that no one leaves Kent behind as we progress on development. This is basically what it looks like. We bring people from around the world to Geneva and we conduct advocacy. We meet with governments, we tell their stories. More importantly, they tell their stories. We have myself on the right, and we got Imania, who is from Samoa, Fafafini. We've got two guys from Suriname. We've got a lesbian from Hungary, I forget her name, a couple of people from Zimbabwe. And when governments are having their rights reviewed, and you get the government of Hungary comes in and says, I'd like to tell you that everything is perfect on LGBT, we just say, just a moment, we've got someone who'd like to say something about her experience in not being able to get actually a document that allows her to go through passport security so she can't travel, because you won't allow her to change her travel documents because everyone thinks she's still a guy. That's a problem. Or we'd like got this person over here who'd like to tell their story about how they have not been able to even have this conversation. If I was to do this conversation in about 100 countries around the world, I would literally be put in jail. I literally would be put in jail. So we have some problems, and we get people to tell their stories. We also have big moments of excitement. This very same flag was one that we took into the United Nations when we won a wonderful resolution 2 years ago, where the governments, by a majority only, lots of governments oppose still, lots and lots, but a majority voted to establish a specific expert to look into these LGBTI or Hijra, whatever, issues. And that person is now established and working. And governments continue to vote. Just on Friday, like last week, there was a resolution passed on the death penalty, which first of all said death penalty, not a good thing, full stop, but also then said, if you are gonna have the death penalty, make sure that it doesn't apply on people who commit adultery. Don't use it on people who, under blasphemy laws, apostasy, which is like converting from one religion to another laws, or don't use it on same-sex relations. So the votes are still happening and still passing, so there's a lot of progress, and we use this international space to be able to say, listen, we are bigger than me and my country, and I think that I know everything about my country here. No, we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We have these principles beyond which can help and lead us to something beyond ourselves. And for me, to come back to my faith, again, that's an incredibly humbling moment which I have, and I know that my own way that I think and learn in this space and in my daily life, I'm growing, I'm on a journey, I need to learn, I'm not perfect. God, take me as I am today, teach me what I would do today, is a lesson which we then end up bringing into our workspace. This is what the gay lobby looks like. You've all heard about us. We're very scary. According to some people, we're completely changing the world and infiltrating. It tends to be just very boring meetings of sharing facts with UN officials or diplomats from different countries. It's people telling their story. And how important those stories are, because as I've mentioned, the state of discrimination and violence around the world is horrific. This is a map which my organization produces. This is only on LGB issues. This is only on sexual orientation. It doesn't touch on gender identity, gender expression, or sex characteristics that I mentioned earlier. But you can see in the very dark places where the death penalty applies if you have sex with somebody of the same sex. Anything which is red or orange, there is a criminal offense which can put you in prison up to 21 years. The colors are not great there. Russia is has problematic laws that, for example, this conversation could not happen at all, because any time that you're within 100 meters of anyone who's under the age of 18, it's considered to be propaganda of minors. But there are good things going on. You can see, obviously, in deep, dark green places which have same-sex marriage. We have places which have, even if it's not marriage, that at least there is protection of same-sex unions and anything in between. Specifically, actually that map was quite old, so this is almost a better map to look at. We've tried to go in deeper and deeper into what actually criminalization means. So whether it's people being imprisoned for same-sex acts, and some of the laws are actually very, very specific. I won't go into gory detail about how they literally describe the sexual act of one person with another one, this intrusion into the bedroom of everybody. But it's not just those kind of laws. Sometimes it's also morality laws or decency laws, which can be just applied very liberally by police on the ground. So we have very problematic situations across the world. But there are places where there are protection laws. This map shows countries where there is legislation that protects somebody who is in their employment from being thrown out of their work for being gay. And yes, the United States does not have that law. And this map, oh, is it not a map? There we go. Yeah, this is a good one. I think there is such a degree of moralizing that we do to each other. Because I can be immediately labeled as, like, you know, the liberal leftist gay lobby, and I'm there to go and preach and tell everyone how to be converted to my way of thinking. And that's often when we face that in advocacy, is when you're sitting down with governments in very complex situations, and we're asking our friendly government, someone like the United Kingdom or France, who are very pro, is saying to them, you've got to be careful how you engage in this advocacy work. And I found again that my own faith has been so important for me, that when I enter into those spaces is to not go triumphant, righteous, and judgmental. And particularly with governments, and we've worked with a lot of European governments for them to go in and say, literally 15 years ago in some European countries, it was still criminal to be gay. And across this continent, you still have the requirement that anybody who wants to change their gender has to be sterilized. So somebody who's capable of having children but wants to change their body has to be sterilized in order to get a change in their passport. So what we do is then working with European governments for them to be able to come and say, we come to this United Nations table not as a preaching post-colonial government. We come learning ourselves that we have created and caused pain, and we continue to do so, but we all need to change. And so some of that humility. Maybe I should have done this one earlier, but when I talked about the people we bring, my organization is a federation. We have 1,300 member organizations around the world from some of the most difficult places. They're the ones who come to speak in Geneva. And they're the ones, they elect a board and they tell me what to do. I don't get to go off and do my own thing. I'm kept in check by those who really are affected, which is good. I've spoken a lot, so I will pause right now. I've also got another bit that I could talk about, which I mentioned earlier, which is my work on the reference group on human sexuality, which is to talk a little bit more about what I'm doing more in the church realm on changing conversations, where I've been talking more about the secular space right now. But I'm just going to pause in case people have any specific questions right now that they wanted to raise. And also so I can get some coffee.
So I want to raise a question that you may be addressing as you go through the next section, because I think it is very much about the intersection between secular and sacred. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Sarah Stevens, and I work in counter-human trafficking. And though counter-human trafficking is about exploitation in many industries and areas, a major part of it is combating sexual exploitation. And in our sector, we have a lot of debate about, you know, is there a place for sex work? Where are people in control of the situations and choosing, or where are they driven into it because of the injustices of society? And so I wonder if you could, in some way, talk about how that conversation goes on in your community.
And in good moderator style, I'll also say, any other questions before I take on? And I think it's, thanks Sarah for that question, because I think it'll start coming up. And in fact, maybe I will just zip to it, if I can just get to it. Because I think, yeah, Genesis, always a good place to start, right? Question, you know, when I go to Genesis and I read this, in the Garden of Eden, we were naked and we felt no shame. And then the very first thing that happens when God finds out that we, whoops, did something, you know, it's our nakedness that we became scared of. And I know there's many different ways to interpret this, and I am not a theologian, I emphasize, nor am I a priest or anything like that. But for me, what I see very early on there is that issues of nakedness and sexuality and intimacy about our bodies is something which overwhelm us and enter deep into our faith and our connection and our spirituality as well. In some ways, it's the physical embodiment of the most intimate spaces with us, within us. And I think for that reason, it's obvious to me as to what happened immediately after this was one person immediately started blaming somebody else and said, "You did it. No, you did it." And then you roll on just a few more verses and suddenly we're killing each other and brothers are killing brothers. And I think what happens is like that there's something about the nakedness and about I'm fearful of my nakedness, but I immediately start lashing out at those around me because of that, sometimes irrationally, because I cope with it. So I'm not sure if that's not logically set out, but for me, I think that hits on issues of sex work as well, because what we do find is that emotions rise on any issues related to sexuality, whether that is sex work, whether that is LGBT, questions of HIV, AIDS, and it even starts to touch on issues of abortion and many other issues as well, which are related to our nakedness. And I think that there's a gift in those moments, but there's a huge vulnerability. And I think that's why it becomes such an area in faith spaces, but therefore in each of our daily lives, of deeply humble navigating and deep healing as well. Because when I sit in the United Nations and I have governments pressing the button and spewing rhetoric against this and saying, how dare you try and sexualize my children and destroy the idea of marriage? And what are you trying to do? Do you want everybody to have sex with everybody all the time? Sometimes you have to pause and say, is this really about me? Or what is it? Is there something about the way you are in your journey? What is your fear? What is your anger? What is it? What is it there? And I think some of that's been, how we approach and listen to people. And then to pause and to say, I am not going to talk about abortion, I am not going to talk about LGBTI rights, and I'm not going to talk about comprehensive sexuality education. I'm going to talk about Rani, and I'm going to talk about Kent, and I'm going to talk about Liz. And again, to just keep bringing it back to people. So don't let's talk about the issues. Let's again get back to who are these fearfully and wonderfully made human beings. Let's hear about the stories of how this person is experiencing their life. And I think, and I don't have the answer, but I felt that when I look at Jesus and his life, and the one that comes back to me time and time again is the people who wanted to stone the woman, right? And was it that one where Jesus then just sat down and ended up drawing in the sand and stuff like that? And I think that sometimes that's exactly kind of what we're supposed to do. It's just like we pause, we sit down, we recognize the person in a situation, rather than getting into a huge discussion on adultery or LGBT. So I'd love to hear other people's thoughts on this one. So very briefly, my work with the World Council of Churches. The World Council of Churches, in its wonderfully complex and ongoing way, established a reference group on human sexuality. These are members of churches of the WCC, and myself and one other expert who've been invited over a multi-year period to sit down and see how can we help churches engage in conversation on these issues? How can we have this kind of conversation in more places? And I think what's really important is it's not the reference group on homosexuality, it's the reference group on human sexuality. And that's why I kind of flip forward to that slide, because it comes back to issues about all of us, because all of us have a sexuality. Yeah? And what does it mean to have those? So what we're doing is we're working our framing in this reference group is to understand the inherent dignity of the human being, that we explore spiritual beliefs around the role and sanctity of the body, that we come to understand good sexuality as joyful communion and intimacy with others, and we note always the spiritual imperative to include and empower the marginalized. And I think it's that last one, which you know, I don't think we always have to enter into and have deep conversations about everyone's bedroom. That's kind of your business, right? Like, there is a level of intimacy and closeness and privacy around that. But why do I feel the need to come and preach and preach and talk and talk? It's simply because of this number four. It's because we do use issues of sexuality to enter into other people's bedrooms or into other people's bodies, and we feel the need to therefore impose, and not just to preach, but to exclude and to hit and to kill, you know. So I think what we keep trying to do in the reference group on human sexuality, theology, 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 humanity, bring it back to the people. But what is then a way, what is a spiritual way forwards? How can we discern the Spirit of God moving in this 21st century? And this is a little bit, this is how we try to do it. We keep coming back to stories, to faces of people. How do we respectfully have these conversations and the deeply different cultural contexts? Having this conversation in France is very different from having this conversation in Mongolia. It's very different from having this conversation in Argentina. And I think the last point on there is the vulnerability is a safe space, a way to have this discussion. It has to be fostered through a way of allowing people to open up just enough on issues which they are fearful about, but are actually able to be guided safely through that conversation. And we have to learn the strength to be able to talk to the right degree about these issues. So learning to bring personal stories without opening yourself up completely to then be shot down later. And this verse is very precious to me as well, because I think what I find in my work, and it's not certainly not just me, it's so many people that I meet with, it's heavy work and it's complicated, and you can even see I'm struggling for words, and I do this all the time. And again, it's a bit, little bit like, we don't know, we only see darkly now, we will know. But for the moment, I know that there's a moment of surrendering. And when I come here each Sunday, and when each day I get up and I surrender and I say, this is too much for me. These stories, I mean, there's people imprisoned in Tanzania that we're working on right now. Chechnya is still ongoing, Nigeria, Costa Rica, Honduras, many, many places. Too much, God. So that's not just unique to LGBTI, huh? I know that. We all carry that. Whether it's racial discrimination, you know, whether it's people being, because of their disability, whatever. But there is pain that we carry, and for me, that's the spirituality. That's the spirit I find working. And another thing which I have found very much in this church as well, which I think has become a very precious song to me, those of you who know it, take or take me as I am, summon up what I shall be, set your seal upon my heart, and live in me. And I think there are so many ways that that can be taken, and that's a very personal prayer, I think, for everybody in this room in your own way. I also know that it has perhaps special meaning in some ways for lesbian, gay, and bisexual people and transgender people on the first line. And also summoning up what I shall be, the idea of becoming the person I was meant to be, something very precious to trans people as well. I am created wonderfully and beautifully, and yet I am also in a way of becoming. And so this has been precious to me personally, but also in my work, and I think it's a prayer that's shared with each of us on our own individual journeys. So that's me. Thanks. And more questions and discussion.
Andre, thank you so much. I remember some years ago when we were first getting acquainted that you said that you were sharing a bit about how difficult it is as a person of faith sometimes in relating with your LGBTI colleagues and friends. And I wonder if you could talk about that a bit, and also particularly what that means in terms of the mission and witness of this congregation.
Yeah, thanks. And there's only one thing worse than coming out as gay in amongst Christians, and that's coming out as Christians amongst gays. at least in this continent and in kind of North America in particular. And I would find that that's a very, and that's an obvious, there's obvious reasons for that. I think so many, I'll use the word queer to be inclusive of the entire alphabet, so many queer people have felt deeply excluded and therefore hostile against the church and faith in general. And so when I came out in my work as well, my boss is a wonderful atheist. A year in, he said, if I'd known you were a Christian, I'm not sure I would have hired you. Now, he was half joking, but I mean, I still remember the kind of visible shock on his face when I'm like, he's like, well, can we meet on Sunday? I said, well, it has to be after church. And he's like, what's going on? So there's a lot of, yeah, there is some tension there. I think what is exciting, though, is I find that that angst is much less in other parts of the world. If you go to Uganda, I haven't been there, but I've been working with some Ugandan groups recently. Without a breath, they are praising God and fighting for LGBTI rights. They may not be allowed to go into their own churches, but LGBTI communities get together, and when two or three are gathered in his name, they get on with it. And I've seen bunches of trans women deep in prayer, praying for God, praying to God for help through the coming week. And I think that's, again, been wonderful, and that's part of what I love about my work, is you see it in different ways. And it's, you know, we tend to find that it's mainly the Abrahamic faiths that have a deep hostility to sexuality and a deep mistrust of gender. But when you get into indigenous faiths, when you get into certain parts of the Buddhist faith, certain parts of Hinduism, you're finding a lot less hostility, and that's been really comforting. And I've also seen, I mean, I just want to give testament to the number of Christians working in different contexts on LGBTI issues and in different ways. Some of them are rights activists with flags. Others will never wave a flag anywhere, but are doing deeply wonderful work, whether they are queer or not. And I think that's something I've seen quite wonderful is, because of the oppression, LGBTI used to cluster together and fight the world. And what I see where we are on the journey at the moment is other people like saying, okay, you're part of the racial discrimination and the disability and the general discrimination, march with us, you know, on the anti-Nazi marches, and we're all linked. And for me, that's really exciting to see that. For this congregation and church, what does it mean? Great question. Well, I think this place is welcoming. I would not be standing here. I mean, like I started, the fact that I can do this is phenomenal to me. I notice that the way we worship, it's often inclusive of, people hear that in the liturgy. People will come in, people sitting on the back rows all the time. Like, I was a back row listener years ago, and stuff like that is noticed. And so there are plenty of back row listeners today. So I think that's something we should do. And I know that I'm only one of a series of talks this autumn. There are so many people doing amazing work. And in the same way that I will fight on racism issues, I will work for peace, for climate change issues, I think the more that we stand in alliance. So I would just encourage people to not be frightened of the conversation and just to bring sexuality issues appropriately into spaces where you can and just say, have you thought about this? Because when it's, you know, non-queer people saying it, it really is very powerful because it really normalizes the conversation.
Thank you. Many of you know that I just moved from Mexico City, well, from Querétaro. I'm Methodist, and having this conversation in our church will be kind of impossible. My dad is a human rights activist, and he had a conference on church and sexuality, and he got stigmatized since then. And it's so difficult to talk about sexuality within our church, especially, well, I can talk about Mexico because they are very conservative. So I really appreciate having all these symbols, all this conversation that I used to be normal for me, living 20 years in Geneva and having had these conversations in this congregation all through a year to bless a couple. And so I really appreciate that. It means a lot, and it gives a light as well that and reminds me that I have to go back to Mexico and keep on contact with the churches in Mexico and try to share what we see here, that it is possible to talk about it within our churches for the love of our brothers and sisters and to get to see them as what they are, a God's creation. So thank you so much.
As you're speaking, I'm reminded of the very first slide, which you saw me with my little t-shirt on as a kid. There we go. Salvation Army. Those of you who know the Salvation Army, apart from having, well, we have a different flag in the Salvation Army from this one, and sometimes they fly the two together, but that they also have two traditions which I find very precious to me. One is the mercy seat, which is at the front. Rather than an altar, they would just have a seat where you come for quiet prayer. And I remember just before I started working on LGBTI rights, I felt called to come and work in this area. And so I went and knelt at the mercy seat. But the other Salvation Army tradition that I love is you sing happy choruses, and then in between each verses, there's a moment for testimony. And it'll go completely quiet, and then just one person will like shoot up, stand up in the congregation and say, I want to tell you what I am grateful for, and I want to tell you about my story this week, and thank you, God, because this week you came into my life in this way. And for me, that is such a converting moment because, and it's my spirituality and not everyone's, but I do find that connection and hearing somebody else's story of how God has been good to them this week or something that they're facing, but somehow God is there, is such a moment of, oh, this is also how you speak to me, God. That Bible is so precious to me and the preaching is so precious, but you also speak to me in the voices of other Christians. And so when I hear your story and you're talking about what's happening in Mexico, you're basically giving your testimony and sharing and hearing the testimonies of others. And I think for me that is the miracle of how the Spirit works, is through people, and it is through Crystal and Rani and Kent and Nong Thum and Liz and Amira and their testimonies that I also change and hear. So I just want to remember them.
I'm concerned in our time that Christianity is getting defined in the popular culture as over against gay people and over against sex in general. And that definition is out there and being propagated, you know, a lot. Because if you just listen to the popular media, what you hear is all these people saying, you know, if you're Christian, you cannot be gay and be Christian, etc. The only acceptable means is a man and a woman having sex together for children. And that gets propagated now, and there are very few ways that those of us who don't agree that is a definition of what, it's a really feeble definition of Christianity, that it's defined as against gay people, but it's out there and being propagated, and the secular culture doesn't get any other picture of Christianity other than that picture. So how do we, who don't agree that that's the vision of Christianity that exists, how do we find ways so that some people might discover that you can be Christian and gay at the same time, or that there might be a community that could support people being Christian and gay at the same time? And I think that's really important, because otherwise the definition of Christianity is really narrow.
I'll tell you how I do it, and I use social media as well as just in my life as I've worked around the world. It initially, what I found myself challenged about is, as I'm being a development officer in one country or another, I assumed that I was trying to represent to homophobic societies. But then I more and more realized that I was often interfacing with friends who were gay who were alienated by their religious community. And so, one, I've just always been clear, whoever I'm talking to, of my inclusive beliefs. Now, I see Christianity as my driving reason for that, and acknowledging the pain and exclusion that people have experienced from their religious communities, and then try to talk to people about the difference between institution and faith. But then I'm now very deliberate with my Facebook that I often am posting about positive things that church is doing and representing, on a variety of issues, including LGBT. And I, in particular, think of a friend whose birthday I'm going to in Porto in November, who's an angry Catholic gay man and his Jewish partner. And the two of them have said to me over the years that they've found a new entree into considering people of faith because they find that I keep reminding them there is church that is open, that is inclusive, and they don't know that story. They've run away from their communities that hurt them so badly. And so I'm a bridge to help them realize that there are communities that are welcoming and with whom they would find community. And that it hadn't occurred to me that would be a meaningful outreach. I felt a responsibility to speak to those that I feel are being exclusionary, but I didn't realize how I can be represented in to help with healing for those who've been so damaged by the institutions of our faith.
I'll just pick up on that. Like, how we have the conversation is so important. Not just having the conversation, but how we have the conversation. And what I touched on earlier, I think, is so important. I went off social media about 2-3 years ago because I found that we all know this, like, we become echo chambers of ourselves. Like, I tend to have a ton of liberal friends on Facebook, and I've created a whole reality which works and makes me feel comfortable. But the real conversations are those with whom it's really uncomfortable to have those conversations. And that's not just on this issue, that's on a ton of stuff. And I think we each have our contexts on that. So learning, like, how to have conversations with others. I come back to it, when we get into isms and ologies, like, we don't get anywhere because we no longer see the human face. And I don't just mean the human faces here, but I also mean the human faces of our opponents. Like, what is it that makes a diplomat spew forth craziness to my ear? Like, I can sit here and go, wow, this diplomat is crazy. Come look at the homophobe, look at the homophobe. That's not going anywhere. It's a long journey, but it's like, okay, write to him a month later. Would you like to have a coffee? I would love to talk with you. Tell me what's going on. What's your story? You know, and not to be there just to convert someone, but to sit with someone. So that kind of conversation is really, it's really tough. And that's why I come here. That's why I have a faith. It reminds me each day I need it. Really, I really do. And I think the other thing is to, when we're working globally on these issues, is to remember that I'm a white South African. Like, can you imagine how much baggage I bring into almost every conversation I have? You know, with the history of apartheid and colonialism and all that stuff. I have to be sensitive to those issues. And why is it so important that we have the YFK2HS rights rather than the LGBTI rights? It's to remind people this is not a foreign, Western, European imposition on other people. This is just something about being human. Wherever you are, beautifully and wonderfully made. So we try to emphasize that point. And I think sometimes we don't have to wait, we don't have to scream LGBTI. Maybe we have to scream S, H, 2, K, or even the names of those people, because we could get into a long conversation about an identity politics. But that's one of the approaches we use. I'm very aware there's been a very long conversation. If people do need to get up and walk out, you're totally free anytime, but we can keep talking as well.
Andre, I'm sorry I came in very, very, very late, but We were actually having a little conversation over washing the dishes downstairs, and one comment was, what is Christian about excluding a whole group of people? And the rest of us agreed.
Yep. But we do, and I do. I do. All the time. So I also have to take that log out of my own eye. But yeah.
First of all, I wanted to thank you for presenting the topic, which is often not talked about, especially in the Christian context. And, you know, it's a very personal story. I'm very touched. Thank you. I just have a question about your organization's ultimate goal. Is it to protect, these people's fundamental human rights, or is it about, like, marriage for all? I just want to know a little bit more about your goal.
Yeah, great question. Are we here working for marriage for all? Are we working on the fundamental rights of people? Well, my specific advocacy is at the United Nations. Once you zoom out into the entire world, you have to have a global picture. And you remember my slide, which was our starting point, of all people are born free and equal in dignity and rights, one of the opening lines of the Universal Declaration. Preventing violence and preventing discrimination, that is where the conversation is internationally. Stop killing trans sex workers. Stop beating up feminine men walking down the street. Stop executing gay men. Stop. Stop. Discrimination. Don't throw the lesbian couple out of their apartment because you don't like them living next door to you. Don't deny health care to the trans man who still has gynecological needs. Could go on, okay? So that's the level. At the same time, yes, of course, what discrimination has means for specific places has meant that people have said, we're at a point where we think that one way to give effect to this is to have equal marriage. And so you've seen different societies have reached that point. But the United Nations international law, this is the legal bit, does not require same-sex marriage in the world. What international law requires is that if you have couples living together, they should be protected in the same way. So quite a lot of countries have reached civil unions as a way to do it. Each country has its own journey, each society has its own journey. Some societies have gone on a journey which says, well, we can't, in all conscience, have a different label for one set of people and a different label for another. Imagine if we said that black people get married under this label and white people get married under this label. So I think a lot of people have then reached the point and say, we're just going to allow marriage for all. But international law doesn't sit at that point. My organization, we don't touch on marriage. Like, that is something which remains at the domestic level for different societies and groups to determine on that. We will support it if it happens, but the hysteria around same-sex marriage, oh my goodness, and don't even get me going on surrogacy and adoption rights, but the hysteria around that is something which we're always trying to say, park this conversation, maybe this is the bit I don't understand now, I only see darkly now, let's park that conversation, let's not forget about the violence, let's not forget about the discrimination, can we at least deal with that? Thank you all, and all around.
Andre, I just wanted to thank you not only for the really moving and helpful presentation, but for also the way this models, I think, a way that our faith maybe engages with the various things that we're involved in life. The way you modeled that for us is really beautiful and illustrative for me too. So thank you.